Thank you, Hieke. Ladies and gentlemen, when I was a teacher a long time ago, they taught me that you should never start before everyone was sitting down and the door was closed. So now we may start for the last part of our conference, not the least interesting, I may say. Of course, that's important to know, because last parts of conferences are always difficult parts. We have very interesting things this afternoon. We have one change in the program. There is a session 8 on conclusions. You do not read there that we have intended by now to make that a panel session. Four of us will form a panel, and then we'll have a discussion just preceding the contribution by Mr. Richard Dice. But before that, we have something much more interesting. We have been talking about education all day today and yesterday, and now we will not talk about education for at least an hour, because we have for a keynote Mr. Frans Leeuw, director of the Ministry of Security and Justice Research Center, and he is a professor of law, public policy and social science research at Maastricht University too. And Mr. Frans Leeuw will not talk about education at all, but he will talk about something which is very pertinent to our theme today: transferring research results to policymakers and practitioners. And I think we may learn a lot from these experiences from the fields of security and justice and development aid. So I'm looking forward to it, and the floor is yours, Mr. Leeuw.
Thank you. Indeed, it is a great pleasure to be here, dear colleagues, although, exactly as the chairperson said, on a final session, you know. Well, luckily it's not Friday, and the sun is shining, but nevertheless it's your final day. So I'll try to make it a little, friendly and interesting for you. Who would want to implement behavior modification programs to prevent and reduce criminal behavior, or digital warfare programs to reduce cyber attacks on organizations and individuals, or just one other example, laws regulating markets and society without knowing what the evidence is upon which these interventions and their assumptions underlying the interventions are based? In this room, probably nobody. So when I was invited to do this talk, I thought, shall I talk about that? But then later on, I thought, that's impossible. 20 minutes, and it is not specific enough, so I thought I'll make a change, and actually also at the request of the organizing committee, I have changed it to first describe to you how in these two fields, justice, security, crime, justice and security, and the other field, development aid, how nowadays in mainly Western, Northern European countries, including United States, Canada, so I'm not talking about the Congo, things are taking place with regard to how research, evaluation, on the one hand, and policy-making, sanctions, law-making, and in the context of development aid, we talk about projects and programs, including national strategies, how they are related, how one learns from the other. And I will give you a number of examples of what is going on and how that is done. And then in the final 4 minutes, I've already ask the chairperson that if that is 2 minutes longer, that will not be a big problem. He told me that will not be a big problem. I try to compare, but compare is a big word for a couple of minutes, so a little bit of a comparison. Try to make a little bit of a comparison between the things that I described in these two fields versus a couple, not more than three, crucial factors that you get from the research on transfer and utilization in terms of what works, what doesn't work. So I try to compare at the end the experiences and developments in these two policy fields and a very little bit of a state of the art of the literature. And it's only one table, so, and it's a snapshot. Okay, so I'll go to... it's working, yes. The first field, security, crime and justice. Traditionally, dear colleagues, the crime and justice field has been rather strongly connected with scholarship for decades. That means, of course, legal studies. Distinguished bow tie professors of law were dominant actors. and still to some extent are dominant actors. Now that has changed. There has been important changes. Of course, crime, justice, and security can never do without jurists, but developments in the field like forensics, with the lab on a chip, encryption technology, deep packet inspection, has to do with cyber, ask for other type of sciences that have now an increasingly strong relationship with the justice and security world. Technology researchers are important, are becoming more and more important. The same is true for the field of socio-neurosciences, in which persistent antisocial behavior, sometimes starting at a very young age, but also resilience problems of victims and resilient problems of police, fire brigade, ambulance personnel are now studied, combining socio, psycho, and biomarkers. Here, social scientists, biologists, and neurologists are active in designing interventions, such as behavioral modification programs, testing them in social lab situations, and bring them to the fore. Neurolaw is one of the most recent topics on the agenda that now reaches policymakers and judges in the security and justice field. And evaluation studies. I'm an evaluator all my life, and I follow this in many different fields. In the field of justice, now you see that these numerous legal sanctions and behavioral modification sanctions that justice systems all over the Western world are implementing, like fines, incapacitation, detention, electronic monitoring, oversight, but also naming and shaming, and I apologize for the very aggressive language, hit them where it hurts, policies for the organized crime, crapule, to use a French word, as well as cognitive behavioral intervention programs, they are all objects of evaluations. And although, of course, less frequent than in medicine, randomized controlled trials, quasi-experiments, theory-driven evaluations, but also large databases to follow criminals over the years to see what is happening, are now on the agenda, are now being produced, and to some extent are used. Now, the question is, what are a couple of crucial practices, maybe a couple of mechanisms, that help realize the transfer and utilization of knowledge by, on the basis of these developments that I just described, in the direction of practitioners, like prosecutors, judges, prison personnel, oversight officials, different word is inspectors, the police, and the fire brigade. And I give you a couple of descriptions of what I see in this world. One mechanism, one institutional mechanism is that several of these northern, western European, etc. countries have, is that they have their own semi-independent research and brokerage organizations. Let me see. No, that's one too early. So you have to wait a second for this next slide. These semi-independent research and brokerage organizations, they can be found here in the Netherlands. So that's the institute that I direct. Sweden, the United States, with the National Institute of Justice, Australia, UK to some extent. Originally, that was RDS with the Home Office, Australia, Belgium, and Germany. Other examples. In these institutions, translational criminology and translational civilology, civilology is a relatively new discipline combining behavioral science and civil law, are strongly on the agenda. And they try, translational criminology tries to break down barriers between basic and applied research by creating, as it is called by my American colleague Laub, a dynamic interface between research and practice. Part of that translational work is that the programming of studies done by the semi-independent organizations is collaborative in nature. Problems pop up from the ground, they are discussed, they are valued in terms of their researchability, their relevance, and their link with the state of the art in academic research, and then are taken by these institutions on board or not, because not everything that pops up and that is believed to be important can be studied. Another aspect of that translational world is that portals, and I mean, it's always a pleasure to refer to EPI with one letter less, that portals are available where results from hundreds of evaluations and systematic reviews are summarized and made available to lawyers, prosecutors, and justice policymakers. I give you two examples. This is the one from the National Institute of Justice in Washington. They are a little bit running ahead of what we are doing. This is not for you now to look into this, but this is an example. And in a couple of months, my own organization, we will launch this portal. It's now in Dutch. Will, of course, also be in English. And that is also summarizing hundreds of studies on what the effects are and for whom and for how long of these numerous behavioral interventions and sanctions, etc. As I already told you, this first characteristic, these researchers, they not only do research, but they also broker the information to the policymakers. Rien Rauw, but it's unfortunate, is in Dutch, did a nice short study on different of these brokerage institutions in the Netherlands. So everything I say you can check with his paper, but it's in Dutch, so that takes a little time. A second important vehicle to transfer is accreditation committees for judiciary interventions. These committees consist of independent experts that carry out ex ante studies of proposals for new interventions. And after they have been accepted, so to say, that means they have to at least have a sound underlying theory and a number of other criteria, they are commissioned for implementation and further research. That's an interesting mechanism of transfer too. One of the other institutional mechanisms in the justice and crime field is to link research and policy. That is through investing in social capital. And in the Netherlands and in a couple of other countries, not in all the countries that I referred to, but in a couple of other countries, a particular approach, which is called knowledge rooms, yes, it's a little bit of a strange word, knowledge rooms, has been rather successful. The knowledge rooms mean sessions between 5 and 10, not in the morning, but in the evening, with the top layer of the departments, the justice department and the public prosecutor and the lawyers, including the politicians, that's crucial, so not only civil servants, for these 4 to 5 hours. No dinner, no wine, except at 10:30, but then only one glass, only sandwiches, coffee and tea and a little water. In these knowledge rooms, listening, debating and framing are central. To give you two examples of what over the last 2 years happened. Human enhancement through biosciences and psychopharmacology was on the agenda within the Justice Ministry. And robotization. Recent examples of knowledge room sessions held in the Netherlands. Okay, these are a couple of activities that take place in this crime and justice field. Later on, I'll try to compare how can they be rated with regard to a couple of important factors coming from the evaluation and utilization research field themselves. Let me go into the other field, development aid. You know, I bring that up not because I like it, but because I'm since the early 90s doing work in that field from my professorship, and I'm also chairing the independent panel of the quality of evaluations in the field of development aid. A first characteristic in that development aid field is that there is a strong international empirical benchmarking, usually done on the basis of research and evaluations. And the benchmarking is of their policies, is of their programs, is of their evidence, the evidence that is underlying development aid programs. The OECD, for example, has a special and very long-lasting committee that develops guidelines on the methodology, the quality of evaluations, and on criteria how to get results used. It's the DAC OECD. The same is true for the World Bank, IMF, and other development banks. Another development there that is helping, at least that's what we hope, to make use of research, is bottom-up networks. Just one abbreviation, the NONI, that's the Network of Networks of Independent Impact Evaluators. And it's a people meeting, people flowing in, flowing out, own website, have their own guidance. So that's really bottom-up. Of course, there's always a little bit subsidy, but it's bottom-up. That is rather different with regard to the field of crime and justice. What is more comparative is that many donor countries have semi-independent research, evaluation, and sometimes inspection-oriented organizations to look into the efficiency, the effectiveness, and side effects of development aid. So that is a little bit comparable to what is happening in the world of justice. The numerous NGOs that, of course, carry out a large part of these policy interventions, they also have their own internal evaluation activities. By the way, not always very good, but that's another question. A fourth characteristic, or a third, that is somewhat comparable to what I described in the field of crime and justice, is the way in which these evaluation and inspection, these semi-independent organizations in the development aid world, are programming their studies. This is also done multi-actor, bottom-up, taking into account social and political suggestions from policymakers, and including from several NGOs. They operate at arm's length from the sponsoring ministry, but they do not live and work in splendid isolation. So again here, multi-actor, a little bit using social capital to get the program of research going on and developed in such a way that it continues to have a link with the policymakers and the sponsors. Much more, though, than in the field of crime and justice, there is interaction in the development aid world between private and public organizations, in which R&D and transfer are central. Very well known, well, maybe not for you, but then at least there is something new for you this afternoon. It's a CIGAR. That means C-G-I-A-R, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, in which some 15 research and transfer organizations are bundled. Private money, public money. The Africa Rice Center, the Biodiversity International Institute, the International Food Policy Research Center. That's totally unknown of, unheard of in the field of crime and justice. It's real combinations of public and private money. I have been on the board of auditors of the CIGAR a decade ago, and I vividly remembered when I thought about this speech, how intense our debates in those years were about the impact that the findings of CIGAR studies have and should have on farmers' behavior, et cetera, and how to get this big set of data and findings and studies get on the agenda. Actually, one of the 15 CIGAR institutes was ISNAR, that's now a special division, that had only one task: to think about, develop, and understand and evaluate transfer and utilization. It was here in The Hague, I think 10 minutes walking. Now it's in the United States. That's a little bit bad for the Netherlands, but it's good that it is still there. So that's different. That you don't have in the field of justice. Let me end this very quick sketch with on the development aid field with pointing out to two very short other characteristics that are important for knowledge transfer. The one is, similar to the crime and justice field, increased importance attached to repositories, let's say to the EPI work, the JPL poverty lab, it's there. At least some 15 repositories, let's say, are available. And the most recent one is developed now by 3IE. That's public and private money combination. Plus, also totally different compared to the justice field, there is, driven by the World Bank, and you know, the World Bank is an organization that simply can say, if we like your shop, we buy the whole thing. They run the IBDET program. The IBDET program is a 12-year-old global program for getting degrees, certificates in periods of 3 to 4 months, you know, really on-the-spot learning for program evaluation and methodology in the field of development aid, as well as utilization. The very well distinguished, very well known and distinguished Michael Q. Patton, that probably most of you will know, he is also part of the key faculty. I do that also already for 12 years. It's thousands of people, mid-level career people, younger people, and even you know, heads of statistical bureaus in Africa. They have been pumped through this system, and it's done together with Carleton University. Very interesting in terms of transfer. Okay, dear colleagues, I have only a couple of minutes, so let me go to the second question. I hope the color is not a little bit unclear. But the question is how to evaluate these activities in these different fields, though related fields, to what I dare to say a snapshot of a couple of important findings from research, robust research on utilization and transfer. But before I'm there, I'm going to say something nasty. And I hope that maybe all of you, but at least a couple of you, will tell me that I'm wrong. You know, I like utilization and transfer ever since I was starting to work in research and academia. But it's not my specialty. So I did a couple of relatively quick Web of Science and other investigations searching for research evidence, robust, for me is that theory-driven, good designs on what works for whom and when you deal with transfer and utilization. And I ran into fantastic papers, but with somewhat depressive results. For example, these two, a paper in Knowledge and Evidence by Bum et al. Very recently, had 800 papers to discuss this problem, and it could only include 13 serious studies in their review. We know that from many, many fields that is happening, but it is apparently, I hope I'm wrong, it's apparently maybe also true for the field of research and transfer. And this very recent paper in the American Journal of Evaluation, 52 studies, or what was it, something like that, and you see there are simulations, quite interesting, but you know, what is a simulation? Case studies, nice, but what do you learn from it? Narrative reflections. Surveys, but not, longitudinal. So this is a study in the AGA, also asking, putting on the agenda, how much actually do we know? Anyway, what I did, I looked into a couple of these studies, and I had a list of a couple of factors that I thought are very important. If you want to go for transfer, I only give you three of these factors, so I forget a lot, but what I did, I hope we can all read it, and if not, I'm happy to send you this table. I'm happy to send you the PowerPoint. So I had the three factors, that is social capital, relational assets, as it is called in your field, between researchers and policymakers, time, research time, evaluation time is not similar to policymakers' time, so you have to take care of that, and knowledge marketing aspects, summaries, is there a website, is it a two-way website, is there a repository that works just like with Epi, you open it and you see home cooking, it's a wonderful topic and you even can laugh with it, not about it, but with it. And I thought, how do these things that have to do with security and justice and development, how do they link with these factors? And, dear colleagues, it's a snapshot. It's not, a rock-bottom research. So the Kenniskamers, the knowledge rooms, long tradition and interaction, that is, to some extent, strongly related to social capital. And then the bottom-up networks in the field of development aid, and the bottom-up interactions between, organizations and NGOs is really an important element there. However, there is also the danger of capture, but I cannot discuss that. Time. As there are own semi-independent research institutions who are at arm's length of the ministries, they are instrumental for delivering in time, for an adequate time management. Let's say, to some extent, you train your people to come up with the results at the moment that they are needed. That sometimes means that you have to give in a little bit on the methodological quality, but for the other situations, you can plan. You can try to plan. So for me, this arm's length organizations is of some relevance for taking care of the time factor. The similar development is in the field of development aid. You can see that there is this programming, plus they have benchmarking, international benchmarking. So that means if the DAC OECD, if they are stressing the time factor, it is difficult to, in your own organization, forget about it. Because, you meet these people and you are, let's say the institutions are compared to some extent. And then finally, the knowledge marketing aspects. There we have the easy accessible portals, the clearinghouses. In for example, the Netherlands, there is now a clearinghouse for lawmaking. It describes crucial mechanisms that make laws successful or not. And that clearinghouse now is advising to policymakers and lawmakers that make new laws. And the same is true with regard to the development aid field, where you have these portals, where you have 3IE, and where you have the private and public cooperation. And they really take care of knowledge marketization aspects. I think that's it. Let me summarize. Well, not summarize. That's impossible in the 1 second that I have. These are two different fields for you. On the other hand, education and development is strongly related, and education and crime and justice is strongly related. We all know good education, lower chances of crime and more development. Nevertheless, it is very well possible that you think, wow, why am I listening to this guy talking about social neurosciences and that is not my piece of cake? If that is the case, I apologize. If you find it of any interest, I thank you for your interest. Mr. Chairman, am I doing in time? Well, not, but maybe this is it.